Welcome to Energy Unplugged, the go-to podcast focusing on the global energy transition. My name is Salman Khan. I'm a principal in Aurora's Oxford advisory team, working extensively on transactions and projects involving fixed assets and flexibility markets, apart from natural gas, renewables, and hydrogen sector in GB and Ireland. In today's episode, it is my great pleasure to be talking to David Watson, CEO and co-founder of OMI, a global EV smart charging platform combining hardware with proprietary software, allowing EV drivers to charge during the most economical time periods. Prior to founding OMI in 2017, David worked in financial markets as a risk manager and portfolio manager at investment banks and a hedge fund, focused on asset-backed securities and credit instruments. OMI is not David's only business. David additionally co-founded Temporis Capital in 2010, with which Aurora is well familiar with, alongside his business partner, Derry Guy. The topic of this episode is the future role of EVs and smart charging within the electricity sector. The UK currently has more than 1 million fully electric cars on the road and 620 plug-in hybrids. However, we need 10 times this number in order to reach the UK government's target of 10 million EVs by 2030, all of which would need to be supported by adequate and smart charging infrastructure. So David, I want to start with giving our audience some context in terms of the background of OMI. Could you help our listeners grasp OMI's technological capabilities, in particular explaining how their charging hardware, a physical product, is capable of interacting with market signals to enable a car to charge in these economical periods? And is OMI a cable producer or software producer, an EV aggregator, and how do OMI services work in practice in general?
Well, sorry, first, thanks for having me. I'll try to answer that question by, I guess, answering the last question and say we are a software and hardware provider and effectively an aggregator. So we are, I guess, all of those things in one, and they're different meanings to different people. But I think we feel all the components are required in order to deliver a decent service. I think the best way to try to describe how our technology works is probably kind of to think about what it feels like for an individual user. So, you know, an OMI driver would have an OMI charger. That OMI charger piece of hardware has got a 4G SIM card in it. So it allows that charger to speak directly to our cloud. So that allows you to send instructions directly from the cloud to the charge device. So the first thing you have is a charger, and then you have an app. So in that app, you have to add in a few different things. So the app, in the app, you write down, you tell us who your car provider, what your car is. So that allows us to estimate the size of your battery, but it also allows us to communicate directly. You know, if you have what we call a car API, communicate directly with the car and figure out at any moment in time which chair is in the car. So that's the first thing you do. The second thing you do is you tell us who your energy supplier is, and then the last thing you do is you tell us how much you want in your car, what period it. So that's what the app effectively does. So why is that important? You come in, you plug in your car at home, and the first thing the OMI app does is it goes and says, okay, so what did this driver want? This is, okay, this driver wants to be 80% full of days at the clock in the morning. It that knows that because you set those rules in your charger. Next thing it does, it goes to the car and says, how much is in the tank? So you owe 60% of the tank. So there's about 20% left. And they say, oh, I need to be ready by 8 AM. So we go, okay, so we've got to get 20% into the car by 8 AM in the morning. So the technology effectively then goes, okay, so who's your energy supplier? What's the cheapest way to do that? What are the cheapest times in order to put the 20% in the tank? Does it calculates a schedule and sends that schedule back to the charger, and then the charger goes into schedule mode and then waits till the times and the periods that energy's cheapest, charges the car in those times. And in the morning, you wake up at 80% full, at cheapest you possibly could, given your energy provider. So that's effectively at the core. So the core of it, there's a 4G connected, beat the hardware connected to our cloud, which is connected to your app. That cloud is also connected to the car backend. And that cloud is, in very many cases, connected to the energy supplier. So as the energy markets change, or the things change, the signals change, or the the instructions to on-click cloud changes, and that allows us to then update charging profiles and charging schedules to effectively still give the customer the cheapest energy. As simple as that. So it's a combination of hardware and software that allows you to effectively provide the service.
Right. And David, just so that our audiences understand the interaction, how do charging infrastructure providers such as OMI collaborate with energy retailers to provide competitive charging prices?
So I'd say that whole thing is evolving. And so in the very, very first, when we started first, there wasn't any real concept of time of use tariffs in the very first instance. So when I spoke to Greg and Octopus at the start, and they decided to create a couple of simple tariffs. Go, for example, was the first one where they would give a simple tariff structure where they would say it would be cheaper to charge 12 to 4 a.m. And so the OMI driver, you would say Octopus go on an OMI charger, and then the charger would just effectively start at 12, finish at 4, and all you wanted was the super cheap energy for those 4 hours. And that was quite a big step forward, because at that stage, tariffs couldn't do timed charging, and people used to have to get up in the morning to effectively early in the morning go in and plug and unplug their car to get the cheapest energy. The next evolution was an agile tariff, which was linked to the energy prices. So every day the energy supplier would effectively, or Octopus in this particular case, because they were first moving, and they would publish a further agile price file, which would be effectively half hourly energy prices for the next 24 hours. So our cloud would see, our environment would see that on a daily basis. And then we would then on each given day move the charger to the cheapest half hours in order for the customer to get their cheapest price. And that was quite innovative at the time. And then, we had some quite variations in energy prices and, in positive sense. And then lockdown came, energy prices went negative, and people were paid to charge. And load was moved to those times, and that was quite nice, because it was like a fast forward of where energy markets were in the future when the supply demand imbalance shifted to times when energy prices were negative. However, over lockdown, through the energy crisis, Ukraine energy prices went higher, energy price volatility went higher. So in order for energy suppliers, Octopus in particular, the first one to go again, to continue to add, to provide super cheap energy, we had created a much tighter integration in the form of Octopus Intelligent Go. And what that involved us doing is to effectively update the schedules, or update the pricing schedules on a much more dynamic basis, in order for the energy supplier to be able to demand or to be able to buy energy when those choice prices were changing on a much more dynamic basis. And it also transfers some telematics to them to allow them to see and predict what amount of energy they will get in a period. So as opposed to just moving it to a period of time, it was to move it in a more dynamic format to a cheaper period of time, and then give them an idea of quantity. Why was that quantity important? Why is it now important? Because it helps them to manage effectively their imbalance. Every half an hour, energy suppliers need to have a balance between supply and demand. So as you have more and more volatility and more and more EVs on your system, it becomes much more important not just to move to the cheapest times, but to actually know exactly how much you need to do. So that is, from an energy supplier's perspective, the journey we've been on, our own technology is on an Octopus. You might have been the first mover, but there's a number of other energy providers in the UK now are starting to provide similar sorts of tariffs. You overdrive anytime. And again, they have that much tighter integration between much more dynamic price files and much more dynamic signals and telematics in order to deliver what, from the customer's perspective, is manifesting itself in super cheap energy.
Yeah. So David, in order to keep up with the flexibility requirements for charging to be dictated by real-time price signals, how does OMI approach the challenge of ensuring this hardware and software keeps up with these demands?
I think that the fact that we're an integrated hardware and software player makes it easier for us to do that, because it gives us more speed and ultimately joined up. And on the first instance, the UK brought out the smart charging regs, and so that meant that you had to quite quickly introduce different functionality onto your hardware device. And that meant a combination of firmware changes, hardware changes, and backend changes in order to satisfy those regs. So if you were a hardware only provider, you'd have to have somebody else help you with the backends, or if you were software only and you were trying to work on somebody else, then you're depending on your hardware manufacturer, whoever's providing the hardware, to make both those hardware and firmware changes. So overall perspective, the first is the fact that we were fully integrated helped us do that. Second thing is, in a world where you have to turn on and off cars, a lot of cars don't respond as they should to smart charging or standardized protocols. So you actually have to have much more controlled firmware on your hardware in order to be able to consistently turn on and off charge. That's the second phase. And then the last piece that I said was that, we talk about moving towards intelligent or much more dynamic pricing, then ultimately you have to be able to, most of that works in the back end, effectively ensuring that you integrate with that energy supplier provider, that you pass over information in real time. And the second, because you're now delivering a service, your connectivity and the reliability and the charges come into play. So actually, in order to be able to evolve, move, and iterate in a speed that allows you to keep up with changes in the market, that fully integrated software and hardware piece has helped us to stay on the edge. I mean, at some stage in the future, I think things will have more standardized approaches to all these, whether it's the hardware platform and or interfaces with various different energy suppliers. Also, more stabilized or more standardized market structures and stuff. And when you have all of that, then it gets easier to exist if you are a hardware only or a software only provider into that. But at this stage, when things are evolving and changing, markets are evolving and changing, then having a fully integrated approach has given us a pretty decent advantage.
David, I want to take a brief step back to 2017 when you were working alongside your business partner and you decided to branch further into the smart charging systems. I want to take this discussion further and talk about the market signals required for successful deployment of smart chargers. Other than your keen interest in the clean technology sector, what were the particular market signals in 2017 that made you take a leap of faith outside the world of investment management and step into the technology developer and the operator role, so to say?
Well, I think the first one was that, I guess, got me interested in thinking about it was energy price volatility. So I could see with the higher penetration of renewables on the grid that price volatility and imbalance were becoming things that were becoming more and more prevalent, that something the system needed to manage. And so I started looking at batteries as a means to managing that imbalance and volatility. And it's quite clearly now that you do. But as I looked at batteries, I could see them following a Moore's Law curve in terms of prices. And the first thing was looking at that Moore's Law and that signal and that trend convinced me that batteries were going to be cheaper. And at that stage, you had Teslas and a few cars driving around the place that were high quality, lower carbon, more efficient. I thought, well, actually, they'll be a lot cheaper. And so on that side, you're going to have something a lot cheaper. You've got the battery trend, something that's going to be a lot cheaper. And the government regulation was pushing or beginning to move towards pushing more towards EV. And at the same time, which was, I guess, the last market trend, I could see an acceleration of investment from the various different OEMs or car manufacturers towards EV. So all of those things together convinced me that the mass adoption of EV would be there much before people thought. And look, that's the volatility, I think, was a given, the volatility of price. But ultimately, in order to capitalize or manage that volatility, you needed EV, so you needed an asset. So I think the thing that I had to believe first was that EVs would come. And then once they would come, I think I had that fundamental belief that volatility and imbalance would be things that would start to increase, and the two would combine together to give that opportunity.
And how do you think these market signals that have evolved over the last 7 years? You see a big thing?
Well, I mean, on the battery prices, I think when 2010, the battery of a Tesla Model X was about 100 kilowatt battery, about 120,000. When I started looking at that, the battery was about 35,000, and now it's about 8 or 7. So we've seen that part of it drop, and we've seen huge investment from OEMs across, at that stage it was single billions, now it's tens and tens of billions across all OEMs into new EV trends. We've seen mass adoption. You know, we've gone from 0.1% types of numbers of EVs on a system to 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 95% just always. So we can see that huge number of EVs. So they're above government regulation has cascaded around Europe and the world in terms of the banning of cars, and volatility has increased significantly. Volatility of energy prices, and volatility isn't a great thing for the system or the consumer, but it is the thing that, you know, flexibility or cheaper energy for people with flexible assets could have feeds off of. So that's there. So I think it's pretty much where, or within the shape of it. I mean, who knew exactly where each of those things would be exactly in 2024, but the direction of travel is almost certainly in the direction that the science had shown back in 2017-18.
I mean, you're right. The market signals have, you know, at the time, and then since the last 7 years, they have evolved. But do you see the consumer market also taking a certain direction? Is that something that you've thought about, or do you think that there would be, let's say, 10 million EVs on the road in 6 years? Is that something that you foresee as well?
Well, in some ways that it happened slower than I thought for the first couple of years. So 2018 and 19, it was quite slow and didn't take off quite like I thought. And then in 2020, 2021, it started to explode pretty much across Europe and China. The volumes went crazy. And now to have, you know, again, this year, maybe if we include China, there'll be like 14 million plug-ins sold globally, which is an extraordinary number. It's more than every plug-in that was sold all the way up all of 2023. So these numbers are absolutely phenomenal in terms of size, scale, and speed. And I think for me, whether it was a year or two earlier or later versus my original one, now looking back, I think to see so many vehicles, even a million on the UK road, as we've now fully electric by 2024, I think it was beyond most people's imagination back in 27 or 18, but it's a pretty decent achievement.
And as I understand, David, you're currently embarking on expanding OMI across Europe, Australia, and the US markets. Do you see a variation in terms of market readiness across these geographies for EV infrastructure?
I think the infrastructure is largely driven by EV penetration. And so there is a pretty decent dispersion amongst penetration across various different geographies. However, the speed that, I guess, countries move along the curve is a lot quicker. So, you know, in Northern Europe, with places like the UK, Germany, were at 0.1, 0.2, 0.3% for a long time, and then quickly went up to, or started over the last couple of years, went up about 15 or 16% EVs. Scandinavia being except Shepson or Norway being 5. Some other countries have got into that ballpark a lot quicker. We still do have, some countries that, you know, Southern Europe is still around 4 or 5, which is lower. So it's 1 in 20, but Australia, for argument's sake, was virtually nowhere 2 years ago, and now is 7 or 8. So things, as the vehicles become affordable and there's more supply across differently, I think the vehicles will arrive, whether it is 2 or 3 years different than where they are on that. But ultimately, when you have a certain number of vehicles, then that drives the structure and change. And okay, so that's from that, I guess, the EVs that provide, I guess, potential for flexibility. On the other side, you have to, in order to provide the right structure, you need a certain type of energy market. So the UK was kind of ahead in terms, one, the liberalization of it, and two, I would say volatility of price because of the penetration of EVs and renewable, and a couple of suppliers that were cutting edge and prepared to create more dynamic tariffs. So the UK has, if you look at it across all the ingredients you need, which is the cars, the volatility, the energy markets, and the suppliers, the UK is, for the purpose of providing smart technology or even, or flexibility, the UK has all the ingredients behind. So it's a little behind in maybe EV penetration. So as I propagate that model across the world, you see various different countries in various different stages. But the UK, after Europe, energy price volatility is increasing massively as a result of solar on tops and an erosion of demand we've seen over the last year or two because of gain prices. So we've now got much higher volatility in Europe, which is incentivizing energy suppliers to start creating much more dynamic tariffs versus this launching in Europe. So they're catching up on the energy piece, which then now they have EVs, the energy piece comes together and then you see a speeding up of the infrastructure of the things you need to build a smarter energy system. So that there is a decent dispersion between countries, but they're all starting to migrate at various different paces to the same place, but not the same order for each component, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely does. I want to touch upon how smart charging can serve the grid in the best possible way, and then what are the opportunities on the GB energy market. As you might be aware, that Aurora's bread and butter is to identify and quantify the system level impact of different energy scenarios, outcomes using our own robust market level model. And some of the classic questions that we are often asked by our flexible energy client base is what is and how will the role of transmission and distribution connected battery distribution level batteries evolve over time, for example, through increased balancing and ancillary service market participation that is helping the national grid balance the supply and demand, as well as helping the overall system operation, such as managing inertia, frequency levels, etc., in addition to what our expectation on the future depth of these market is. You will, of course, know of Octopus Energy's and National Grid's recent trial, which aggregated EV units to form mini power plants to dispatch into the balancing mechanism. Octopus Energy, of course, extrapolated the results from the trial and stated that if all 10 million EVs that are expected to be in the UK by 2030 participated in the balancing mechanism, system costs would be reduced by almost 100 million a year. With respect to EV batteries and their interaction with the GB system, do you think there would be enough demand for charging in the next decade to have a real impact on system operability challenges such as managing the transmission level grid constraints?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is yes, but I think it may be instructive to break it down into, I guess, the size of the asset or the potential asset. And to see whether, you know, you believe that has an impact. Let me give an example. So you said there's a million in when you plug it. So pretty much at the peak in any moment in time, if you have a million cars, there's about 330,000 plugged in any given afternoon. Simple way, a third of them get plugged in every day. So at 7 kilowatts, that's potential, if they moved in harness, 2.1 gigs of power that can be either turned on or off. Now, what does that actually mean in the context of your grid? You get grid, you've got peak power demand of about 35 gigawatts, 25 low off peak. So we've got already the ability or potential ability with the existing EVs on the network to move or to turn on and off 10%, get or 8-10% loads. And as you said, that by the time you go to 10 million EVs, that's far greater at any moment in time than even the total energy demand if they moved in concert. So the impact is big. And then in that moment in time, you have, you know, our studies see that when you plug them in, we have at the potential for about 8 or 9 hours of charging at that moment in time. So you have something that's 8-10% of the load that if you wanted to use and do is an 8 or 9 hour duration already. So that's a significant amount of flexibility in an asset that could be used. There's another study, and so that kind of shows you what the potential is. There's been another already, I read another study yesterday that said the impact already or the avoided cost on the system because of the vehicles up to date has been about $3 billion in the US system because of the smart energy charging. At the moment, and that ignores all the avoided infrastructure costs that would have happened in local networks if it had been dog charging. And where did that saving came from? It came from the fact that with simple tariffs, you were able to move demand the cheapest time, keep up asset utilization on the system, which effectively resulted in lower overall system costs and cheaper energy for consumers on peak times because suppliers were able to pass that on because of that. And so already we're seeing indirect benefits on the system of renewable that just disrupt the potential, and you see some benefits. As we move further in time, we'll get more, you know, then EVs will be able to participate in explicitly in some of the other markets that exist. And there's a couple of trials that when there's presently Winterflex that happens to see if we can reduce, or not we, but the system can reduce demand specifically from EVs and other assets at those peak times when we have those capacity crunches, which where we would normally have had to ramp up CCGT grants and that's running through. And we're running quite a large project with Octopus and National Grid and all SSC, it's called CrowdFlex, which is actually beginning to quantify the basic flexibility that exists or the value that exists in the system with these units. So I think there's a long way of answering the way I believe that they will have a big impact. I think they'll have a phenomenal impact on the system, and they're already at the size and the scale that they're providing system benefits. And that's only going to get bigger at an exponential rate.
Currently, David, the smartness of the OMI's chargers come from the capability to read real-time price signals, choosing economic hours to charge. Well, however, you still are looking to expand into the V2G space. Just for our audience, for the benefit of our audiences, V2G is the utilization of a battery's EV battery to feed into the grid, enabling it to also respond to an increase in demand. So I want to talk a little bit about the technological challenges vis-a-vis V2G. So what do you think are the main technological challenges facing the EV sector in terms of deploying V2G?
Okay, so I'm sorry if I'm trying to spell it out too much, but there are, with V2G, one of the main questions or main challenges is around whether we go DC or AC V2G. And what do we mean by that? Well, then the power of the grid is AC, alternating current. And in order to get it from the grid into the car battery, you need to get to DC. So in a normal car, there's an inverter, a one-way inverter to allow you to get that power from the grid into the car in DC. If you want to get it back into the grid, you have to get that DC power back into AC in order to push it back into the grid. So you have two choices. You either have a two-way inverter in the car, so that you get AC and then that gets pumped back into the grid, or you have another inverter in the house that takes the AC off the car and pushes that back into the grid. So historically, car manufacturers only had one-way inverters. So a lot of the earlier or a lot of the current versions of V2G involve DC chargers. So they take DC back from the battery and then invert that in the grid. Problem with ultimately with that approach is, the difficulty with that approach is, it's the cost of the DC charger. It's not about an inverter. It's a much bigger unit. And that then has the barrier of cost. It has still the issues around, the cars being V2G enabled. So you have to be able to communicate with the charger. And or the car needs to be able to communicate with the charger. It needs to be able to be have two-way flows, even in a DC. And then the charger has to satisfy local grid code, which, you know, then what do I mean by that? You can't just pump AC back into the grid from any sort of device. That device has to have local grid code approval, and there has to be a mechanism to come into it. So you have a DC in the world, you have, it's okay. So you don't need to put an inverter in the car. You can satisfy if you can satisfy the local code, if there is a code that works, but you have a commercial barrier, because it's quite expensive and the payoff is not there. On the AC side, which theoretically is a lot simpler, the cars that manufacturers could add a two-way inverter into the car, then a pretty simple home charger with some slight modifications on the existing home chargers would be able to take that load and feed that back into the grid. Complications with that is that inverter in the car now needs grid compliant for each individual country. Because VW would have to have a different car or whichever car manufacturer would have to have a different car for UK, France, Germany, because of different grid codes. So that car they would have to produce would be different. You'd have to have local grid compliance. And you'd have to have that local complete compliances, even if it satisfied the Greek growth, they'd have to be in a way for the to be you to still legally do it. And ultimately the last barrier is you still have to have a standardization communication protocol between the charger and the thing. So AC is cheaper, would be theoretically cheaper, but has its own barriers. And presently at the moment DC was miles ahead because you didn't need those two-way chargers. But now we're seeing two-way inverters appearing in cars and I guess an emergence of a potential battle between AC, V2G and DC, V2G.
And do you see this, do you see like a variation in V2G readiness across geographies that you're aiming to expand into, or is it all the same at this point?
Look, ultimately, from a car perspective, if it's an AC proposition, the car manufacturers have to bring out a car that has specific, that inverter has to have specific grid compliance. And the ones that are emerging are only available in a handful of countries, or whichever one or two. They don't bring them out for every country all the time. So on an AC world, there's a much bigger diversion between country readiness and in terms of it happening as a capability. And the ones they're bringing out tend to be the ones they bring it out because there's no, or they're bringing it out because of the alignment code. So that's there. On the DC world, theoretically, there's less dispersion between the countries because the manufacturer of the DC charger can effectively make their charge compliant with local grid codes. It's whether there's a regulatory framework to safely eject back into the grid on that. So there's less dispersion in a DC world between which countries could be V2G ready theoretically. And in an AC world, there's a fact, if other countries are ready, but have a technology package or suite that's ready, there's much more dispersion across the potential AC V2G world.
Changing tech now slightly to how smart charging serves the end user and what are the challenges in the retail market. As you know, as of February this year, we know that there are 100 million electric vehicles on the road, 620,000 plug-in hybrids, and then the target is to get like 10 million. In light of the current UK government's announcement to delay the introduction of an internal combustion engine ban from 2030 to 2035, what are the incentives that are required from either the public or the private sector to drive this increase in the EV uptake? For example, do you think it's going to be subsidies for the buyers or communication on the fuel cost benefits or further government?
Well, I think from the government perspective, intervention or the government perspective, I think they've done notwithstanding the regulatory change that occurred, I think in terms of the salary sacrifice and things they have for corporate buyers, I think it's quite good and quite a good system. So that's encouraging quite a lot of purchase on certain fleets. They've just recently brought out some new subsidies on tourist houses to be able to get across with pets and stuff to help unlock that because there is a barrier. So because that is bringing or will bring a new cohort of people into the market. From our perspective, what we're trying to do is to educate people at the time of purchase or buyers or even the stakeholders within the mobility ecosystem that the benefits of cheaper charging. It's cut for running EV if you have off-street parking, which for the UK is the vast majority of people, then running an EV is significantly cheaper than an internal combustion engine. And for people like us and most of the people in your audience, that is pretty obvious. We all think everybody knows that, but actually when you move out of our circles, it's not widely understood that it only costs on the cheapest energy tariffs, it only costs £150 to £200 a year to run an electric vehicle if you have off-street parking in the UK. So I think that, you know, that industry and people like us, the real trick is to tell that story on both cheaper energy, easier running costs and stuff. And as I said, we've got lots of programs, lots of educations. Lots of educational programs among the dealers, OEMs, and the partners we work with to help their salespeople understand that so they can tell a story to buyers. Because presently there is a lot of FUD out there and a lot of people are talking about negatives and EVs, and that is, I would say that's more of a headwind than any change in government policy presently.
Yeah. And in the future, how do you expect competition to evolve between different energy retailers to offer competitive charging prices for EV owners?
Well, I think that's already starting. I think for a period of time when we did have the energy crisis, there wasn't too much switching. So, you know, a couple of the energy companies did evolve and continue to evolve as they tried to provide better deals for their customers. But now we're back in a more normalized energy environment. I think they're back actually to find and attract those newer connected newer energy companies. And, you know, somebody with an EV tends to get a heat pump and they tend to move down the trajectory. So they consume twice or three times the energy and they consume it with suppliers once. So they are notionally or potentially high margin customers. So they're going to and will continue to do to create more innovative tariffs and participation to a whole host of different flexibility services. And what that will do will make charging cheaper for those people that engage with those services and ultimately drive the fact of, you know, the fuel part of wanting an EV down. So these things, it's already happening, just sort of more of what we're seeing, but I think at an accelerated pace now that we have a more normalized energy market.
And David, last but not the least, what are the top three ingredients do you think are required for seamless integration and widespread adoption for smart chargers in the future? Do you think it's like something like more digitalization, more cross-sector collaboration, or government policy intervention, or anything else that you think is going to work?
I think there's only two things that are really, really required now. I think they've done a lot of what they've needed. I think they need to create a regulatory requirement, and then they're working hard in order for the maximum number of players and types of players to be able to participate. So you kind of try to create an open environment. I think if you don't have that, you don't have an ability to drive competition or innovation. But the most important one are the pricing. So to create the markets to stimulate the innovation or actually the investment, because, you know, I think the technology is, or the companies are there with the desire to have either technology or they can take the technology one step forward. The number of chargers in the market were out there and the volatility there. So all I believe is we need is proper, or the market or the system needs price signals to ultimately drive the print paper. So in any market, if it doesn't exist, you know, the first thing is set it up and create the right price signals. And in this particular case, if you will build it, they will come. I think it's the right time to do it because of the number of assets. So I think they're decreed. I don't think you'll regulate your way into a smarter system at this stage or force people into it. It's just you. I think it's the carrot. Is the carrot now will be the last thing that will tip the system over the edge.
And David, might be interesting to ask you on a personal note. Like there might be people in the audience who might be on the edge of buying an internal combustion engine car or like an EV. How would you push them towards an EV? Like, is that something that you can talk about a little bit?
Let's be honest, it's a very different proposition to buy an EV if you have off-street parking. Yeah? And people who have off-street parking and find that very easy have a different world. So I will talk from that perspective first, because they're the easiest ones. If you have off-street parking, when you look at the convenience and the reliability of it, it's phenomenal. It's, you know, you come home, plug in, it's cheap, it's there, and you don't have to go to gas stations or service stations. And my wife and a whole lot of other people have to say it's great. They don't ever have to go to a garbage again. It's easier. They won't go back. In terms of driving and handling, an EV center of gravity is low to the ground and it works. It's a much better and easier thing to drive and reliable and generally have less technical problems. So if you've got set up, your charging is reliable, it's cheap, and there are no EVs on the market. And when you look at them from a leasing perspective and total cost of use, they're cheaper. They're definitely cheaper. So if you're one of those, it's no problem. If you're going to spend a lot of money with an internal combustion engine, I would say, well, look, don't hold on to it for too long, because I would really question the residual values of those internal combustion engines much beyond another 2 or 3 years down the line. Why do I say that? Well, I read a an anecdote of a guy in Ireland. He was just driving. He bought a secondhand EV. Sure, four more. He said €5,000 more, €4,000 more expensive than equivalent. He drives a lot of miles, but he saved $2,500 this year charging the car. So the payoff and the residual value, the floor value of something that's super cheap to drive versus the alternative is going to then be the current choice once we have a decent secondhand market of BEV. So I would say if you're worried about your pocket or you're worried about the resale value, you have off street and you have those. I think pick an EV. There's plenty of choice there. They didn't used to be when we started, or I started looking at it. There was two or three types of models of EVs on the system. Now there's hundreds and hundreds for all sorts of people. There's plenty of range, lots of anxiety. So I think I would say for somebody like people who don't presently, I'm being honest, if you don't have access to that setup and all you do is have access to then fast charging, let's say, and that's not easy. You do have to think carefully because you have to think about how it fits into your lifestyle. You have to fit it. You have to think about how you can charge it, where you can charge it. Yes. And if fast charging at a really cheap price or expensive price or whatever price it is, it's okay for you and you want convenience your house and that's what you want, then that's when you help make your decision. But I think you really do have to concentrate when you think about it is what's that charging piece and how's that linked to the EV and what are the economics? Because actually an EV, when the charging is cheap, easy and reliable, is the best thing in the world. If it's not, it can be very hard. Because certain parts of the system, well, they're catching up. They still can be quite complicated for lots of people. So I think that's what I would say.
David, thank you so much for your time and answering all my questions. I know there was a long list that we had to go through, but I really appreciate your time. I'm sure that our audiences also will be delighted to not just hear from you, but also hear about the incredible work that OMI is doing in this EV space. It was really great to talk to you, and a pleasure.
Thank you, Salman. It was my pleasure.
That was Salman Khan, a principal in Aurora's Oxford advisory team, talking to David Watson, CEO and co-founder of OMI. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to follow or subscribe to the podcast via whatever platform you use.